This is David Miller, Psyche's Poetry, September 28, 2007.
Nobody understands what I mean. Only a poet could begin to understand. Now, the bad news is, since most of us are not poets, I mean, some of us write verse, but we're talking about serious poets. Since most of us are not poets, it means we can't understand Jung. That's the bad news. I mean, I think that's the end of it. I mean, I could stop there. only a poet could understand. Nobody understands my psychology. Now, the good news is that before Jung said that, Ananda Kumaraswamy once said that a poet is not a special kind of person, but every person is a special kind of poet, which means we all can understand him. if we understand him from the standpoint of our poet, what Lee Roloff talked to you about several weeks ago here. Now, what I want to try to do tonight with you is to talk for about 50 minutes, and we'll take a little break, and then we can talk about this. But what I want to try to do is to try to figure out what Jung meant by that 2 years before his death. What he meant by saying that only a poet can understand depth psychology. Notice he did not say only a poet can feel. He said only a poet can understand depth psychology. The answer may well depend on which Jung we're talking about. In a little book, Dialectics and Analytical Psychology, which I know some of you know about, in which I had a conversation. I had a conversation with Wolfgang Gigerich about his thought. I mentioned that Jungianism came in three waves, and I talked about his thought as being third wave Jungianism. I mentioned that, but I didn't explain it in the book. I'm going to explain it tonight. What I was thinking was on the model of feminism, third wave feminism, first wave, second wave, and third wave feminism. You know how that goes. The first wave of feminists was the equal rights part of feminism, that women should get paid the same amount for equal jobs, and that women should be allowed to vote. Suffrage, questions like that in the 19th century as first wave feminism. Then along comes second wave feminism from the 60s to the 80s. And a different political issue was raised. It was politicized such that personal lives were seen to have sexist structures in the family. And all issues of equality, not just voting and work, were raised. And when those issues were raised, all the way from the economic issues to reproductive issues, when those issues were raised, then there was an attempt to foster a common female identity. What it meant to be feminine or female or femaleness. And that was stressed. Well, that was bound to give rise to third wave feminism, starting with the 90s on, Judith Butler and so on. And in that, Judith Butler is going to say, and other feminists are going to say, wait, who's this? Who's this one female identity that we're all supposed to be? Maybe I'm different from another woman. Maybe my feminism is different. My feminine nature is different. And so diversity was stressed. Anti-essentialism, there is no feminine essence. Anti-essentialism. Especially there was talk against upper middle class white female identity. So that color was stripped, women of color. Consciousness about post-colonial theory, critical theory, transnationalism, transgender, ecofeminism. Now, what I was trying to point out when I had my conversation with Giedrich, who's recorded in his book, is that same thing happened in Jungian psychology, I think. First wave Jungianism would be Jung and his circle in Zurich, right? Second wave would be represented by what came to be known as archetypal psychology, where image and anima, soul, is the basis of Jungian psychology. This is celebrated by the work of James Hillman, also in the work of Paul Kugler, Stan Marlin, Noor Hall, Lynn Cowan, and others. The typical text for this is Revisioning Psychology, Hillman's book from 1977. It was his 1975 Terry lectures at Yale, and also his book Dream in the Underworld, 1979. Now, along then comes Wolfgang Giedrich in the third wave of Jungian thought, and emphasizes not anima, but animus. Giedrich, Greg Bogenson in Canada, Toshio Kawai in Japan are other figures in this third wave of Jungianism. The principal text of this is Giedrich's very difficult book, Soul's Logical Life, 1998. And especially his book, Animus Psychologie, which has never been translated to date, though it's being translated now. He wrote that in 1994. Now, all of these three movements of Jungian thought, first, second, and third wave Jungianism, have something to do with poetry, the poet, just as all the waves of feminism have to do with women. So I'm going to take them one by one tonight and inquire what each one of them has to do. With Jung saying, only the poet can understand Jungian psychology. Let's start with Jung. Now, actually, Jung doesn't help much at the beginning of his life. On the contrary, in 1902, when he was 27 years old, he was writing on so-called occult phenomenon, psychopathic inferiority and hysteria, especially among women. And he said, and I quote, "Persons with habitual hallucinations draw attention to themselves like poets." That's not so terrific. And then he adds, "Artists, saviors, prophets, or founders of new sects." In 2 years later, in 1903, he was writing on manic mood disorder, and a case reminded Jung of what he, and now I quote him, "the miserable lives lived by poets and artists, who with small talent and indestructible optimism eke out a hungry existence despite the fact that they possess quite enough intelligence to do good work in ordinary professions." You see, Jung is not helping us very much. In 1905, when Jung was 30, this is pretty young, he's writing on cryptomnesia and wish fulfillment, and he says, "Poets are usually beguiled by their own ideas and believe them to be novel, and of course, they are not." Now, this is the young Jung, who protested too much, as he put it, "Ich bin ein Empiricer, I'm an empiricist. I just tell things like it is." But he also once wrote, late in his life, close to the time when he said only a poet can understand, he wrote to Maud Oakes in Toronto. She recorded this in a little book called The Stone Speaks. And he looked back on this period of his 20s and early 30s, and he said, "I no longer lie. Once I had to, as a young scientist without a reputation." So Jung, on a matter of poetry, between his later life and his young life, was not consistent. Don't worry too much about that. Some wag once said, consistency is a virtue of small-mindedness. Don't worry about it. all the great thinkers were not consistent. Marx, Nietzsche, Plato, Thomas Aquinas. But in the middle period of his life, Jung shifted. And it would seem that in the middle period, he's more helpful about what he meant late. In 1916, when he was 41, he was giving a lecture on the structure of the unconscious, and he says, "The poets have supplied a good deal of evidence regarding the soul and the soul of psychology." That's exactly almost the same words that Freud used at his 70th birthday party when he announced, "The poets knew all of this business about depth psychology before I ever came along." So that's Jung saying the same thing. In 1921, when Jung is 46, now he's approaching midlife, writing on the typology, the type, psychological types, he says, "The poets are always the first to divine the darkly and mysterious moving currents and to express them as best they can in symbols that speak to us. They make known, like true prophets, the stirrings of the collective unconscious, which in the course of time will inevitably come to the surface as a collective phenomenon. Therefore, we psychologists cannot afford to be indifferent to poets, since in their principal works and their deepest inspirations, they create from the very depths of the unconscious, voicing aloud what others only dream." Pretty strong. Again, in 1924, when he was 49, Jung, in a London lecture, said, "The primordial images in poetry are a mine of psychological lore. That is, you want to understand the archetypal elements of dreams, read the poets." And finally, in 1930, when he was 55, he said, "Psychology and aesthetics will always have to turn to one another for help." Now that seems like he's getting closer to what he said later. But this effusive turnabout, affirming the psychological importance and relevance of poetry, smacks, to me at least, of romantic assertiveness, especially in light of the context of that last sentence. "Psychology and aesthetics will always have to turn to one another for help." He also said in the next sentence, "The creative act, being rooted in the immensity of the unconscious, will forever elude our attempts at understanding. It can be guessed at, but never wholly grasped." Now, not only does that sound romanticist, splitting thinking and feeling, thinking and poetry, putting them in opposition like mind and heart, but it's odd, since 29 years later, he's going to say that understanding is possible only through poetry. Here he says it's not possible. That's a subtle shift. This smacks of what Freud called Gedankenschreck. It's a wonderful word in German because Schreck sounds like shriek. What it's meant to sound like, it means fear of thinking. Freud found many of his patients have Gedankenschreck. They don't want to talk about it in the analytic hour. And Heidegger called this der Flucht von den Denken, the flight from thinking. And Wolfgang Gigerich's criticism of Jung called this a flight into the unconscious, or as Jung called it, and Gigerich quotes him, a sacrificium intellectus, a sacrifice of mind. So this romantic praise of poetry doesn't help any more with the question than the irrational critique of the poets, of the early ones. It's just a flip-flop. However, there's one moment in Jung's life, comes late in Jung's life, just 7 years before the conversation with the Chilean poet. In 1952, now Jung's 77, in the Swiss magazine journal, Mercury, Martin Buber had written a diatribe, a screed against Jung, especially about his book, Answer the Joke. And Jung responded in kind. He wrote an angry response. This was in 1952. There's been an attempt to translate this response, and if you read the various translations, the one in 1957 in Spring, is also translated 1973 in the journal Spring, you'll find that the translations differ completely. Like you're not even reading the same document. And the key sentence is this one. I'm going to tell it to you in German and then I'll translate it. Ich will hier einmal ausnahmsweise, this is a terrible sentence. I mean, the translators are to be pitied. Ich will hier einmal ausnahmsweise transzendent spekulieren, bezehnungsweise, and now this word is in quotation marks, dichten. Okay. Ich will hier einmal. I will hear once. Only once. Ausnahmsweise, exceptionally, transcendent speculieren, speculate transcendentally, bezehnungsweise, that is, dichten. Now that goes with the personal pronoun I, and so it means I will poetize. I will poetize. It's very odd. You can see how it's hard to translate that, to make it make sense. What is he talking about? Well, my hunch is that Jung did this more than einmal, more than once. And this is not an ausnahmsweise, an exception. Did not Jung write? I mean, look what I'm driving at here. I'm suggesting that maybe all of his psychology can be read as poetry. The whole thing. He was poetizing the whole time. I mean, didn't he write? He did. Every psychology, my own included, he said, has the character of a subjective confession. Even when I deal with empirical data, I am necessarily speaking about myself. Every psychology, which is the work of one man or woman, is subjectively colored. He also said, every interpretation is an hypothesis. Now, it's not a far leap from psychology is subjective and a confession to all psychology is poetry. It's close. And Jung did write once, our science is a language of metaphor. Our science is a language of metaphor. I don't think the Jungian psychologists always understand that. And we talk about the anima and the animus and the self and the ego, that's home. It's a metaphor. It doesn't refer to you. This is radical stuff, if we take Jung seriously. Now there's even more direct confirmation of it. Of Jung's sense of psychology and poetry. In Memories, Dreams, Reflections, the autobiography, he describes hearing the voice, twice in this book, he describes hearing the voice of a female patient who informed him that his work was art. That's what you'll read in the autobiography. Now, it's generally assumed, everybody I talk to assumes that this was Sabine Spielrein, one of Jung's lovers. John Kerr, in the book A Most Dangerous Method, talks about Jung getting the notion of the anima, soul, from Spielrein. And he asserts, without giving any evidence, Kerr gives no evidence, but he asserts that what the voice actually said was, your psychology is not science, it's poetry. In the transcripts, however, Jung says that the woman was Dutch, not Russian. You're right, it's Russian. He says that the woman who said this in the transcript, that in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., this hasn't been published except by one person, Sonu Shamdasani, in his article, Memories, Dreams, Omissions. And the one Dutch woman in the Jung circle in those days was Maria Mölzer, whom Freud and Yolanda Jacobi both claim was also Jung's lover. So it's a weird thing. But some woman said, we can believe her, that your psychology is poetry. Now, we don't know exactly what that might mean. But there's also, finally, this strange, weird thing about Jung imagining that he had a family connection to the poet Goethe. Completely false. But he insisted on it, and he imagined it. His mother said to him one time early, "You must read Faust someday. Goodness, Faust." And after he read Faust, he says in the autobiography, "I now realize Faust meant more to me than my beloved Gospel according to St. John." And he also said, "I regard my work on alchemy as a sign of my inner relationship to Goethe." He said that when he first descended into the unconscious, he didn't have the right language to express it. But he found that language in alchemy, and the clue to it was Goethe. Now, Jung did not win the Goethe Prize for literature. Freud did. Not for medicine, for literature. But Jung did assert an intimate, even if false and fantastic, connection to this archetypal poet. Maybe he imagined, could it be, as he implied to Seurat, that it was the only way that he himself could understand his own psychology. In any case, you can see that Jung seemed to want it both ways. He wanted to be thought of as a scientist, and he wanted to be thought of as a poet, or an artist. Look, like Yogi Berra said, "When you come to a fork in the road, take it." Jung did. Now, on the other hand, in second wave Jungianism, James Hillman wanted it one way only: the way of poetry and image, metaphor and multiple meanings. Ironically, Hillman wanted it the one way of multiplicity. Hillman and archetypal psychology, therefore, seems to have a closer take on why Jung might have said only a poet can understand depth psychology. So let's look at the second way. Now, the major articulation of archetypal psychology that Terry lectures at Yale, published as Revision of Psychology, right in the beginning, Hillman says clearly at the outset that in order to make of life and the world a veil of soulmate, which itself is a phrase from the poet Keats, it will take a psychology of image, he says, that is, these are his words, a poetic basis of mind. Now that sounds like Hillman's that. Like Lacan, attempting to return to Freud's most deep and radical insights against prevailing trends, especially in Europe, of Freudian psychology in the direction of ego developmentalism and away from a depth psychology, Hillman also, like Lacan, wanted to pick up on Jung's most radical edge and fight against what he saw as a weakening of depth psychological insight in the Jungian community. Hillman was clearly on a mission. In the book Interviews, he will write, "I trust my anger. It's my favorite demon." "It's polemical," he says. "So many hatreds boiling up in me all the time." And very recently, last year, in an interview with the Pittsburgh Jungian analyst Jan Marlin, Hillman said, "I work from my anger." Now, I think of this like the anger of the Hebrew prophets. After all, James Hillman's grandfather was a rabbi. And the prophets, you remember, were angry all the time on behalf of God against the people who were idolaters, that is, who were getting it wrong. And it was, therefore, for the benefit of soul that they were angry. And Hillman's anger has been on behalf of, it seems to me, the soul of the psychological work and that of his patients. In the interview with Jan Marlin, he fears, as he did in the book 100 Years of Psychotherapy and the World is Getting Worse, that psychological theory and practice, and now I quote him, this is a little bit of an offensive quote, has become years later a kind of New Age substitute for life. It has become a substitute for rigorous education in culture, philosophy, and religion. It has become, stupidly, a helping profession, that is, to help the ego and its perspectives, itself a sort of narcissistic character disorder. Hillman then says to Jan, "I just think Giegrich is right." Do I need to repeat that? Hillman says, last year, "I think Giegrich is right. the whole thing has lost its way. Now, what Gingrich said has lost its way is not only those who follow Jung, but those who follow him. And he's agreed with it. Okay? And then, this is the obnoxious one. It has become too humanized, feminized, personalized, and its language is dead. The psyche has to keep working its logos, making psychology, making soul. Now, in revisioning psychology, Hillman was angry about four things. A new emphasis on person and personalism, a salvific emphasis on health and healing, wholeness, a neglect of ideas and thinking in favor of emotion and feeling, and a humanism that ignores the archetypal and the transpersonal. Hillman's anecdote, the antidote of the poetic basis of soul-making archetypally, was to personify rather than to personalize, which the poets do, to pathologize and to go down and in rather than up and out spiritually, to see and think through, not to look at, and transpersonally to dehumanize in what he called the manner of Renaissance Neoplatonism. Now, the whole point of all of this in Hillman, second wave unity, is to deliteralize psychological theory, to differentiate it polytheistically, give it multiple meanings, to non-objectify, deconcretize, and to defixate the insight of psychological practice and experience. In Terry Lectures, he said, I want to join Norman O'Brown and Owen Barfield in a mafia of metaphor to save the poor people from literalism. That is, poetry shows the way to soul-making. It serves a depth as opposed to ego-psychological understanding. This was the point of his saying, even before the Terry Lectures, that in order to be radically faithful to Jung, even in ways that Jung was not always faithful to his own deepest insights, it was necessary to abandon the word archetypes, which substantialized and concretized essentialistically and universalistically Jungian insights, and rather to use the word archetypal, meaning a way of seeing, that is, the adverb rather than the noun, doesn't refer to things, to essences. This was also his strategy with myth, with the many gods and goddesses. As he put it, myth is the rhetoric of archetypal psychology because it can't be taken literally. Now, Hillman was picking up a radical side of Jung, the imaginal side. Jung indeed had written, I've learned how helpful it can be from a therapeutic point of view to find the images which lie behind the thoughts and emotions of the patient. Everything of which we are conscious, Jung said, is an image. And that image is psyche. It is soul. Perhaps Hillman's emphasis of this aspect of Jung explains a bit the Goethe fantasy of Jung. For Goethe wrote at the end of Faust, the last two lines, alles Vergängliche ist nur ein Gleichnis. Everything that's transitory, everything historical, everything that goes through life is only a Gleichnis. Can be translated to our word likeness, of course, but it can be translated metaphor or symbol. It's been variously translated those ways. Everything you see out there is a metaphor. These are almost the very words that Jung uses and that Hillman fastens on. Jung said, the reason I use a dramatic and mythological way of thinking and speaking is because it demonstrates the processes of the psyche more precisely than concepts. A poem, that's a surprising thing. He's saying that a poem, the metaphors of a poem, are more precise than concepts. I have an example. When Christine Down and I were in graduate school at Drew University, way back hundreds of years ago, the dean of the graduate school brought the really fine poet Howard Nemiroff to the campus to speak, and he spoke on the topic of metaphor. And he was trying to describe to us what a metaphor is and how it makes things precise. And he said he was up in New England, and he was birding looking at birds. And he saw this purple bird out there. And he'd never seen this bird before, so he looked it up in Peterson's Field Guide, the Bible of birding, right? Looked up Peterson's Field Guide. And he found the picture of it. And it was a purple finch. And he read the scientific description, didn't do much for him. And then there was this line that said, "It's like a sparrow dipped in raspberry juice." Now, has anyone ever dipped a sparrow in raspberry juice? This is not something that happens. But that did it. He said, "As soon as I had that metaphor, a sparrow dipped in raspberry juice, no, I never did." He said, "I knew it was precisely what I was looking for. Made precise." Now, I take it clear that Hillman opted for this poetic way of speaking against the mimetic, and that was proper to the psychological work. Like Paul Kugler has said, the productive over the reproductive. Nietzsche says Dionysus over Apollo, the romantic lamp over the classical mirror. To use Jung's thing, Faust Part 2 over Faust Part 1. That's questionable, but that's what Jung says. And about this focus on the poetic, Hillman said, he was adamant, this will be clear, "Every resurrection fantasy of religion may be a defense against death. Every rebirth fantasy in psychology may be a defense against death. And every dream interpretation that translates into daily life and its ego concerns is a defense against soul." Poetry is crucial because it's not literal. It affirms the cruciality of image, metaphor, myth, and it has multiple meanings, so you can't get fixated on any one. Now, it would seem that there's not much to argue with here. Wrong. Nothing is ever simple, right? Some of Hillman's followers in the second wave of Jungian psychology began to literalize Hillman's deliteralization and make that into prose. And they began to make a monotheism of his polytheistic perspective. Let me put it more directly. Myth and poetry were mined literalistically for ego advice and for sensibility and meaning. Yeah. Myth and poetry were mined, were drawn upon in order to give advice to we egos for our everyday life and give us meaning. Big word, I'll come back to that figure. Now the main problem with this may have to do with the I mean EYE, but you can hear also first person singular pronoun. The possible ocular center, the visual hegemony from this perspective. In fact, Michael Van Noy Adams has recently written a book in which he called Hillman's therapeutic work the seeing cure, as opposed to the talking cure, because of the image. Now, Hillman gave a great deal of attention to the visual, on seeing, on the vision of ideas. Not only does this fly in the face of feminist critique of the sexist hegemony of the phallocentric and voyeuristic male gaze in European and American philosophy and psychology, back as far as the Greeks, as in the book by Luce Irigaray, made that point. It also works against Hillman's own most radical Bachelorian view of the imagination, in which the imagination is not a function of the ego that produces images of perception, that make pictures, but is rather the poetic function, according to Bachelard, of deforming ego's images of perception. It has nothing to do with seeing some thing out there. There are no sparrows that can rest. But it has to do with metaphor. In this slippage to thinking that it's about making pictures, art therapy, and that sort of thing. An imaginal archetypal psychology begins to ask what I see what I imagine, the image I experience, the eros I embody or feel, the soulfulness I poetize. And it begins to ask about my soul and my imagination, and it slips into I, me, and mine, or what Lacanians would call the economy of the ego. And it becomes a humanistic psychology, not a death psychology. It becomes advice, counseling. So it was doubtless inevitable, in order to return the Jungian psychological agenda and insight to its most radical depth, that a third wave would rise up. What I think of as animus psychology or dialectical psychology over against anima psychology or archetypalism and imaginal psychology. But I have to stress right here, and I won't have time to go into this, that this third wave is not in opposition to the second wave. Wolfgang Gierig, for example, in Soul's Logical Life, strongly affirms Jung and Hillman. It's not a going back behind first and second wave, but a going on from them. And this third wave has, I believe, additional insight about Jung saying to Serrano, only a poet can understand. Since early on, Wolfgang Gierig says explicitly that Jung's understanding of psychological reality is, and now I'm quoting him, as poetry, a poetic truth that is a psychological truth. If you want to ask me about where I found these quotations later, you can do that. Now, third wave Jungianism may seem to be a return, to a fundamental depth psychological insight about soul, an insight in both Jung and Hillman before Gierig, namely, that the soul itself is a complexio oppositorum, a complex of opposites. What Freud called fundamental ambivalence. Freud and Jung would absolutely agree about that. And Norman O. Brown called instinctual dualism. Life against death, eros against thanatos, love against hate, id against superego, and in Wolfgang Dietrich's terms, animus against anima. Not conflict. Not oppositionalism, but dialectic, back and forth. Archetypal psychology stressed anima in the face of what it thought was a loss of a depth dimension in Jungian psychology. And it saw that what had happened in Jungianism was a development of a mainly masculine hero myth, an attention to an ego-self axis, to the process of individuation, and ego development and wholeness. And that, you know, all of that served to lose soul, lose the depth dimension. Third wave Jungianism notes in that stress on image and anima, animus was suppressed, the other side. Perhaps not so much by Hillman as by some of his followers. Now, third wave Jungianism, Gierig stresses that the soul is always a syzygy, a term from alchemy. It means twins. And in referring to the syzygy as anima and animus, Gierig is radicalizing Jung's notion. Anima is not merely the feminine side of the male personality, nor is animus the male side of the female personality. Rather, the syzygy psychologically has both anima and animus, and all of us, male and female, have both sides. That is, it's a complexio oppositorum, a complex of opposites. Now, if the animus soul side is that of image and imagination, the animus is the spirit side of logical thinking. But by logic, Gierig does not mean rationalistic moving counters by the organ of the brain. And for him, thinking is not figuring things out, like if we use that word in America, nor does it have anything to do with type. Only thinking type 2. No, everybody thinks. We think while we're asleep. Everybody. Thinking for Gierig is more like what Heidegger called das Nachdenken, which gets translated not too well, the meditative thinking. The logic of meditative thinking focuses on difference rather than identity and identification, and it's dialectical. It's always back and forth, up and down. A psychological situation can be that you stay with until it transforms itself by negating itself. It transforms itself into its opposite. You always turn for this with enantiodromia, a term that he said he got from Heraclitus, which is not true. Heraclitus never used the word. He made it up. But that's all. It's in the spirit of Heraclitus, even though it's not. So you stay with the situation in your psychological life until it turns into its opposite. The easiest example of that Freud gives in masochism and sadism. A mother is screaming at her 6-year-old, and suddenly starts crying. All that energy that's going out sadistically turns into its opposite. Now, Giger is saying this happens all the time in the psyche. But it's not enough to let it turn into its opposite, because then what the negative becomes a negative that is positive. It's a new positive, but it's a negative positive. So that also has to be transformed. I can give an example of that from my own personal analysis, if you would like, in the discussion period. I don't want to pause here to do it, but it's a very important part of third wave Jungianism and Giger's thought, and I don't think it's very well understood. The process of the soul goes along through life. Something gets transformed into its opposite, then that gets also negated. The negation of the negation. And that opens into a releasement in freedom. So, and that's neither a positive nor a negative. It's just open. It's the ability to live. Now, in Economist Psychologie, the principal text in which Giger talks about poetry and psychology, which alas is only in German, he shows that this opening of the negation of the negation is what poets do all the time. And he has the middle section of the book is on the poet Holderlin, and he shows how Holderlin does that in his poetry. Holderlin is a poet who knew that the gods are dead. He knew that the gods had fled. And it's very difficult to write poetry meaningfully in our time. But he stays with that problem. He stays with the problem. He doesn't run away from it. It's like Kyle was saying in the introduction. It's like we're glad to be introduced to our nightmares sometimes, like the returning soldier. Except most of us think what we would like to have done is get rid of our nightmares. But in Giger's and Holderlin's idea, maybe if we stay with them, they'll take care of themselves. They'll transform themselves. We go into them. And he gives the example of Holderlin doing this, and he says, the subject matter of psychology is always contradiction and difference. And then Giger says, and I'm quoting him, the soul is not empirical. It's not a transcendent mystery. It's the dialectical life playing between soul and body. Now, that's very interesting, because then we may have another clue to Jung's fantasy about being related to Goethe. Because in Faust Part 2, Goethe has Faust cry out, Zwei Seelen wohnen auf in meinem Brust. Two souls, alas, I have dwell in my breast. That's the synthesis of Jungian psychology, of Hillman's complexio and of Giger's dialectic. Let me make a little move on that that may help with it. Giger describes Holderlin as a poet who is living and working and writing, but is already deceased. And that's another way to talk. But this description comes to another possible meaning of only a poet can understand this, namely dying. The negation of negation is a dying. As Jung put it at the end of his last work, The Mysterium Corinthianus, every advance for the self is experienced as a defeat, who said that, for the ego. Indeed, this dying is stressed by Giger, as it indeed was by Hillman, and also Jung. Here are a couple of Giger's sentences. The person who does psychology, either theoretically or in therapy or analysis, the person who does psychology does either new or other personality. The daimon, the self, the soul, they're the ones who are the one who uses psychology, who deserves the name. Not me. Not the I. Entering psychology cannot be done without some violence, Friedrich says. That's very much like Jung, the end of his life. And then he says, a little controversially, the soul does not need more feelings, emotions, body work. All that's ego stuff. Psychological discourse has to be as the negation of the ego. What it's about, it looks as if only those who are relatively close to death are serious or mature enough to grasp the essentials of adept psychology. Now, philosophers have talked this way for a long time. Montaigne said, to philosophize is to learn how to die. It's uncertain where death awaits us, Montaigne writes. Let us await it, death, everywhere. Premeditation of death is premeditation of freedom. The one who has learned how to die, Montaigne concludes, has unlearned how to be a slave. The constant work of life is to build death. Plato said that Socrates said those who do philosophy correctly are preparing themselves to die. Now, what has this to do with poetry? Everything. Let me give two brief instances of what I mean. John Keats, in a letter to his brothers, George and Thomas Keats, December 21, 1817, talked about negative capability as the thing that is necessary for writing poetry. Negative capability, says to his brothers in the letter, that's when a person is capable of being in uncertainty. Mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Everything cannot be resolved. Perhaps nothing. Giving into dying, the dying of certainty, is crucial. Let me give another example, personal example. Again, at your university, the poet Stanley Kunitz came to visit. If you give a reading, he was poet laureate in the year 2000 of the United States, and he died this year at age 100. I had dinner with him one evening, and I had a wonderful opportunity to talk to him about writing poetry. And I said, how, Stanley, do you know when a poem is finished? Oh, it's easy. I write a poem. I put it in my desk. And sometime later, I open my desk door and there's his poem. I take the poem out and I read it, and I think, that word doesn't belong in that line. I mean, I thought that was a clever word to put in that line, but it doesn't really belong to the line. So I take it out. And I put the poem back in the drawer, and sometime later, I open the drawer, and here's his poem. I open the drawer, and I read the poem, and then I see another thing like that. Another word that doesn't belong. For a whole line that doesn't belong. And I take that. And I realize that I forced it into the poem through my cleverness and my wit and my ego. Then I put it back in the drawer, and this goes on for a while. And he said, then one year, I opened the drawer in my desk, and there's this poem. And I read it, and I don't remember having written even one word. Then he said, I don't. Michael Sells says that's the true of the mystics, too. He talks about their speech as a speaking away. I think the point is that poetizing is not an ego matter. This is that psychology. That psychology is not. Santiago once said, nothing is so poor and melancholy as art that is interested in itself. Ovid, in The Art of Love, says, if the art is concealed, it succeeds. Or, Philip Soyer, nothing is more opposed to poetry than the belief in poetry. Oscar Wilde says it a little more directly, all bad poetry springs from genuine feeling. John Ashbery puts it in a postmodern way, there is a view that poetry should improve your life, that is ego. He says, I think people confuse it with the Salvation Army. Poetry and philosophy. Poetry and psychoanalysis, like philosophy and religion, are learning how to die, or better put, they are a die. Not only is there implied that poetry and psychology a dialectical thinking, it is also a dying, not so much of ego, but egoic perspective, but there is also a letting be, a releasement, a non-attachment to meaning. And that's indicated by a somewhat surprising statement by Jung. He says, we've talked so much about the meaning of works of art that one can hardly suppress a doubt as to whether art really means anything at all. Perhaps art has no meaning, at least not as we understand meaning. Perhaps it's like nature, which simply is and means nothing beyond that. Now, read most radically, Jung here seems to be saying that psyche needs no meaning. For meaning has nothing to do with soul. It's a matter of fixation, attachment to something. This could be seen as a reason why only a poet who is not interested in meaning could understand that psychology, which is also not interested in meanings that are attached to ego and sensibility. That's what Diederich says. He says there is no need for meaning. For the sacredness, for myth or religion as a present reality. On the contrary, we can, he says, now that the gods have become memories, devote ourselves to all the riches of remembering the gods freely without having to hold our breath in awe. The feeling that there should be a higher meaning of life and that it is missing is the illness. Joseph Campbell so compellingly about this in 1957 at the Aronoff Conference in Switzerland. The world, he said, the entire universe, its God and all, has become a symbol signifying nothing. A symbol without meaning. His lecture was called A Symbol Without Meaning. He said, for to attribute to meaning to any part of the universe would be to relax its forces of foe, and the error of the soul then would lodge only in the sphere of meaning. The bow, in order to function as a bow and not as a snare, must have no meaning whatsoever in itself, beyond that of being an agent for releasement, disengagement from itself. No more meaning than the impact of the doctor's little hammer when it hits your knee to make a jerk. And then he quoted Christian scripture. And you know the passage. The lilies of the fields, how they grow, they toil not, neither do they speak. And then Campbell commented, as he did several times in the Bill Moyers interviews, what, I ask, is the meaning of a flower? And having no meaning, should the flower then not be? Our meaning is now the meaning that is no meaning. And if we are to participate joyfully in the world without meaning, we must allow our spirits to become, Campbell said, wild ganders and fly in timeless, spaceless flight, not into any fixed heaven beyond the firmament, for there's no heaven out there, but that seat of experience simultaneously without and within, where the meaninglessness of the sense of existence and the meaninglessness of the meanings of the world are one. It's very reminiscent of the message. Angelus Silesius, for example, says, the rose is without why. It blooms because it blooms. Sandra Varum, without why. And I think of Archibald MacLeish's famous poem, Ars Poetica. A poem, MacLeish, should be palpable and mute, as a globe, fruit, dumb, as old medallion. To the thumb. Silent as the sleeve-worn stone, the casement lays where the moss has grown. poem should be wordless as the flight of birds. A poem should be motionless in time as the moon climbs. For all the history of grief, an empty doorway and a maple leaf. For love, the leaning grasses and few lights above the sea. A poem should not mean, but be. Soul-like poetry, I'm suggesting, should not mean, but be. So, now let me just summarize quickly. And remember the question? Nobody understands what the psychology is. Only a poet could understand. No assessment is able to. Now, combining what I've called second and third wave union, combining as if they're not enemies. We could summarize by saying that Jungian psychology, like poetry, is imaginally metaphoric and dialectically thought. It is full of feeling and life, and it's a dying to all life's attachments. It's multiple always in its meanings, and it's without meaning often. That would be a complex psychology, which is what Jung wanted his psychology to be called. The complexity of psychology and poetry is possibly expressed in the germ of Jung's odd statement, "I will poetize," which Jung put in quotation marks and which translators seem to have a problem. Ich will dichten. The noun connected to the verb, dichtung, means poetry, as one would guess. But it also means seal, gasket, packing. Dichtheit means thickness or density. By a wild stretch of the imagination, I'm reading in here, by a wild stretch of the imagination, in the overtones of the German language itself, Jung's words might be saying that in his psychologizing, he is thickening, complexifying, making dense and rich, dialecticizing. Poetry and psychoanalysis make things complex. With them, our ego plots thicken. Everyone who's been in analysis. Only poetry can understand psychology because poetry knows about thickening. But if that's so, Jung probably made a fundamental error in his statement. Serrano. Or maybe Serrano didn't get it right. Or maybe Serrano didn't get the point at all. Or remembered it in that. With archetypal psychology and object psychology, Hillman and Piegrich agreeing on the death of ego perspectives in soul making, perhaps Jung should have said, no one, nobody, no person understands psychology. The logic of the soul. Only poetry, not a poet. Only poetry understands. Namely, the poetry that's the important dialectic of the self. It's not the poet who thickens. Not the poet who thickens and understands. It's the poetry that thickens and understands. As in Kunitz's case, in which the poem seems to know better than the poet does what belongs in the poem. And that may be why Lacan said, I repudiate my birth certificate. I'm not a poet, I'm a poem. And it may account for a strange statement by the poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Norhall put me onto a remarkable DVD made by George Quashie, which has one poet after another. It's a headshot. In fact, the whole screen is filled with his headshot. And the voice in the background says, what is poetry? So one poet after another says about half a minute or three quarters of a minute. And Lawrence Ferlinghetti is the first one. And it consists of this remarkable headshot of Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and he was terrified. And he looks right at the viewer. Looks right straight into the camera, right into the soul of the person watching this video. And he hears this question, what is poetry? He says, poetry? Poetry is the voice of the fourth person singular. Now, if one were to say to Ferlinghetti, Mr. Ferlinghetti, there is no fourth person singular, I think he would probably say it. Okay. But you know, in an earlier tradition that I work in, theological tradition, there were, for example, when Dante writes to his patron, Pantagruel della Scala, he says there are four ways of interpreting a text. And he gives these four ways of interpreting. These are four kinds of metaphors to watch out for. And the first one is literal. And a lot of people read that text of Dante's and say, well, there's the literal, and then there are three kinds of metaphors. That's not what he says. The literal is a metaphor, too. That is, it's a way of reading. Do you see what that does to fundamentalism? Fundamentalism is a poem, too. It's a metaphor, too. I mean, it may not be the one you like, but it is. So it's not as simple as it sounds. Also, there were a whole string of poets, starting with German Expressionism, Karl Sternheim in Italy, Marinetti's Futurism in France, Barthes' Nouveau Roman. Whole string of poets at the beginning of the 20th century and the late 19th century who came out with programmatic statements against metaphor. They're never going to use another metaphor. Kafka said, the one reason that I almost despair of writing is metaphor keeps creeping in. Image keeps creeping in. Why are these poets against metaphor? I mean, that has to be looked at. Because it's going to sound a lot like Niebuhr's response to Hilma. But not from another psychologist or a philosopher, but from the poets. Now that has to be figured out. So there's a lot going on. Now meanwhile there are some things that... And one more thing that I'll let you talk about. Philip Wheelwright down in Southern California and my teacher Stanley Romaine Hopper were on a bandwagon in the middle of the 20th century, about the 50s and 60s, that what most people mean by metaphor is what Aristotle meant by metaphor, like Homer's Achilles is a lion in battle. That's a metaphor. Achilles is not a lion, it's a metaphor. Well, but there is a Churchian comparison, which is a third term of comparison. Lions are courageous and Achilles is courageous. Okay. Well, my teacher and Philip Wheelwright both led a movement to say that's not metaphor at all. That's epiphor, that's just carrying what they were. But that, you know perfectly well what that means. So it's prosaic, it's not a poem. You could have said it another way. You could have said Achilles is really courageous. Sort of like lions. I mean, or something like that. Well, it's not quite as good. But it's pretty good. I mean, the worst example of... This is what's called epiphor. This is not radical metaphor. And most of the thing, when people talk about using the gods as metaphors in archetypal psychology, they mean epiphor. They know exactly what they're talking about when they say she has a Venusian personality. Yeah, they know. So it's become a new DSM-4, just using mythological language. I mean, the worst epiphor I've ever heard is Thomas Campion. He's a famous English poet. There is a garden in her face. Oh, that's terrible. But diaphor, that's different. Diaphor is like Eliot's. The broken that elucidates the nature of the kingdoms that are lost. Or Alan Tate, we are the islands of defeated caves. I even have a better one.
This is a Holocaust poet. Nellie Sachs, great Holocaust poet.
Yeah. This is the whole poem. Wailing Wall, night. There's no tertium comparationis in that those two lines. Second line is one word. No tertium. You could talk all day. We could have a seminar on 14 weeks. But we'd never find the third. That's radical. That's vehicle. Now that's poetry. That's when two things are juxtaposed, and the aporia, what postmodern critics call the aporia, the gap in the middle, is not articulated, not fixed on. So it doesn't give ego something to hang on to. But it resonates anyway. Wait, all night. Told her. That's all you need. So that all needs to be spelled out. And then the discussion between Giegert and Hellman that some of you are interested in, and the new discussion, this one I'm introducing tonight, is really hot. There is a diatribe by Giegert against Stan Marlin's book, The Black Sun, in like the Spring Journal dedicated to alchemy a year ago. And now Marlin has written a response, and Giegert has written a response to the response that will be published in a book called Archetypal Psychologies, which should be out in March. So some Jungians are really, for clinical reasons, these are practicing analysts, right, who are also theoreticians, are worried about how you take the nature and the logic of psychological reflection. What's the nature of that conversation going on? And why did Jung come? What do you see? Well, I raised the question. Why did Jung say, "Don't be a poet"? Now, where are your thoughts and your questions and your ideas?
If it's close to true, what Jung says about every man is his own psychological theory.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is something that's coagulating, then the easy question is, isn't this all ego? Or, I don't want to overstate it, obviously, but it's an important question. Because if all of this arguing is going on the basis of one individual's position, then aren't they almost refuting their own quest for or their own quest for freedom, freedom from what it is they're actually kind of creating?
Yeah, it's a perennial program. Two things, I hear two things in that. One is a very difficult matter. Freudians have as much trouble with this as humans. I was teaching at the Institute in Zurich, and teaching a group of candidates who were in the final phases of their training program. And we had a week together, a very intensive week together, 4 hours a day, so 20 hours. And so at the end, on Friday evening, we went out and they suggested we go out and have a glass of wine. So after about three glasses of wine, I said, I'm about to go back to the United States and be interested in the audience that seduced me. And somebody said, no. Because you know very well. And I said,
taken a little bit aback by that,
I said,
uh-oh.
I said, no, it's not. We have to take these courses and you have to get your initials in our little book. Take them back to the secretariat. So we've done all this and take exams. I said, well, what's important to you? Our analysis. That's the only thing. Well, it was hyperbole. It was three glasses of wine. And, but uh, it, and it's But the question is, if every person is his own psychology and her own psychology, then how do you train an animal?
Well, there lies
what Newton
has said about being a poet. And you have to be the poet to understand.
Right.
Then you understand
the poet. Right. I would, yes. See, I would think, therefore, that there's no problem. You teach the same courses, but you hear it completely different.
And well, then doesn't that allow one to experience that process as we go through becoming the whole self?
Right.
And to then hold that
right.
sacredly with another as we do for ourselves so that we may become the whole
that would be the idea. I don't know how to say that. I mean, people just don't believe me when I don't think people believe me when I say that. You know, when I hear somebody lecture, it's a poem. I mean, it's full of difficult psychological ideas and difficult philosophical ideas and difficult theology. Look, if you're dedicated to the work, you can do that with the back of your hand. You know. Any good scholar of Plato knows Plato Cole. Any good scholar of Jung knows Jung Cole. All of it. Not just volumes 6 and 7. Which is what all they have to say is observe. All of it. You know what Cole? That's not the problem. It's like learning a script to act on Broadway. You learn the script. You know your lines. That's not the problem. Now what? I'm out on stage. Okay, the second part of the problem is related to the first, the ego part. You may have caught me several times in slips. I caught myself in slips. Actually, they're written into my notes. The slips. I would first say ego, and then I'd say ego perspective. Ego's perspective. Ego is not the problem. I mean, we are. It's where you place ego. How you place ego. If ego, if everything is in ego, if soul is in ego, or if ego is in soul. Now, see, there's two possibilities. Either ego self-axis, like Edinger said. Or it's one is inside the other. And if you read Anthony Joe very carefully, you'll see that he starts out with everything is in me, so I have soul in me. And then he comes to a place where he says, people that think that soul they have soul are like fish that think that the sea is inside. Yeah. No. We're in soul. Soul is the larger term. Self is the larger term. And all you have to do is be in analysis for about 3 years and you discover that over and over again about how there's another piece that you didn't know about that came. So I think it's the placement and not allowing ego's perspective to, I don't have any problem with it all doing ego. It's all also self. I don't know if that's, I meant to be direct. I didn't mean to look at that.
Could you say just a little more about Jung's skating response to Hoover's skating response to Jung's answer to Joe?
Yeah.
It seems like in those skating responses there's some kind of poetry in that.
Yeah, I think so. A lot. That Chris Adley is here. She wrote a dissertation on Hoover. She has strong feelings about that exchange. First of all, there's the emotion in it that you picked up on skating. Psychologically, some nerve must have been touched in Boomer and some nerve in Jung. I think that they were brothers under the skin. Or, you know, just opposites. And so there was a lot of what Jungians call shadow projection. However, the issue, Jung thought, and Buber did not think was that you can talk about the images people have of God or any religious object or transcendental object, philosophical idea, and comment on the how people imagine God, how people feel God, what people think about God, and not impinge, not be saying anything about God. Now, take Nietzsche's phrase, God is dead. That either means that people today don't relate to God in the way that people in the early Middle Ages did. That is, that people aren't theistically oriented. That doesn't mean they can have religious experiences, of course. But they're not theistically oriented. How are they oriented? Capitalistically. Cybernetically. Computers. I can do all the spiritual stuff in the world in a two-week session in a Zen monastery. Or have a wonderful spiritual retreat, but then I have to go back to central Seattle and get to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. And that world is... So either the death of God means that God died, or something about the way I relate to the religious shifted. Jung thinks it's the latter. Buber thought that the reference called into question religion itself. Look, Adolf Guggenbull Craig can write a book on marriage and say the marriage archetype is dead, but that doesn't mean that my marriage is dead. The marriage archetype can be perfectly dead because it's repressive for women, not so terrific for men in this day and age. That old contract idea, dowry. Your people shall be my people, and all that stuff. Love, honor, and obey, especially the woman and the man. And that can be dead, but still, people can be in marriages and have wonderful relationships. So we're not talking about marriage being dead, we're talking about something in what in German one would call the Zeitgeist, something in the atmosphere. I think, therefore, that Buber was talking about the ontological world, about God, and about the reality of religion, which is for him very meaningful, and was for many people. And Jung was talking about how I know something. So one was talking about ontology, and the other about epistemology. And they went like this, and it became hot and heavy because my suspicion, now, this is amateur speculation, my suspicion is Jung also had a religious side, and Buber also had a skeptical side. That'd be my guess. So it's an interesting exchange. They're both very short, and they're published in English. I recommend looking at it.
Related to that, can you say that parables can be understood only poetically? Parables can be understood only poetically.
Well, I would have said parables can only be understood parabolically, but one of the things in the literary discussion about poetry, about radical, what I call via forma lineo, is that that's a parabolic utterance. That's generally called a parabolic utterance. And one of the ways Kafka dealt with his distaste for using images was he would start with an image like Prometheus nailed to the rock. And then he would say in the next sentence, and the birds got tired of gnawing his liver. So the birds go away. They're tired. And finally, everybody gets tired of the story, and all that's left is the rock. Now that's parable. But it's also incredibly strong poetry, and that's what Michael says called speaking away. Now, that's also related to kind of your question. I think it's very important that the students at the Jung Institute read all of Jung and take all those courses so that they have something to speak away.
Huh. what did I do?
What did you get rid of? Let go.
Well, I retired from Syracuse University, and I enjoyed it so much. I went to College Pacifica, and then I retired from Pacifica. And pretty soon I'll stop going to Seattle. No, Lichtenstein says, naming is always taking back what is said. But you can't take it back. And that's what I think Stanley Kunitz's sort of cryptic remark to me about writing poetry is about. He wrote it, and then he put it as how you would say under erasure, little by little. There you go. I was going to tell you about this negation of negation. I'll just give a quick personal example. In a longish analysis in Zurich with the Jungian, I had a dream one night. It was an uncanny dream. In fact, in the hotel where I was staying, bed and breakfast, I saw the ghost of my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, who'd been dead some time. And it scared the life out of me. Then I fell asleep. Right, and dreamed of him, and he was on a couch, sort of like in a barracks, with a sort of a white undershirt, strappy undershirt on, underpants, and he had several days' growth, and he was a drunken bum. Now, in fact, my grandfather was a saint. He was a beloved Protestant minister, farmer minister in Indiana. And everybody, he was known nationally, and everybody said he was a saint. I thought he was a saint. My mother thought he was a saint. Everybody thought he was a saint. And here's a drunk involved in my dream. Well, it took months, that dream. It took months. And after a while, I began to see that what he stood for me was Christianity, religion, my religious heritage, the grandfather of the saint, the preacher. My father was a preacher. He also was a saint. And so I came to feel that there were, as I said, said in the past, the shadows of this tradition that I needed to look at. And that was greatly revelatory to me and made a lot of breakthroughs when I saw that a lot of my guilt, a lot of my shame came from the ideals that were held up to me by my tradition that I could never live up. And that I wasn't suffering from a situational depression like the DSM-4 system. I was suffering from Christianity. So I hated it. I negated it. But the problem was, that was a positive negation. It was, you see, I had posited something. I'd posited religion as bad for me, unhealthy, as psychopathogenetic. And so now I had a new positive, but it was a negative positive. Well, that was, as Jung would say, one-sided also. And it took a lot more analysis before I gave up this negative attitude toward religion. And once that was negated, you know, it wasn't a matter that I solved that problem. With my grandfather, with my mother, with my father, with my religion, with Christianity, and so on. They didn't resolve it. But it didn't come to me as a problem. There's just a complex. You know, just, but it, the negation of the negation opened it so I could live on. Could even go to church. If I went. You see that? How that works? But it takes time. Friedrich's point is it takes time. It took me time. I had to really live and experience first the negative of something that had always been positive. And then I had to, and since that had helped me so much, it was very difficult to give that up. And it just took time. And a lot more dreams and so on. I hope that, it really is, Giger is talking about an actual clinical process here that generally goes on in a long-term analysis, not often in therapy, it's too short, too short.
When you thinking about all the metaphors that we've seen up throughout the country, which create metaphor or dreams or even the waking state of the dream as well, that it's always coming to a certain that is that it's like the chew on the whole within ourselves and in another, however you see. And I was thinking about how we come to those places where we have outgrown something, where we're strong enough to question. Like it's maybe shedding skin, and we're coming into a new essence of ourselves. You know, that is like a thing that, you know, even the integration of the child, of accepting the dark side, is truly, when you look at it, well, why is my dark side? Oh, you know, there's somewhere in me that I'm not strong enough to. So it's a, you know, a good thing to rest with. So, and then the rock, the story about the rock that was left. It reminds me of the poet that we're speaking of in the poem in the drawing, and kept coming back and bringing back into the rock. That you know, when you left the rock, then we shed the ego, we shed all the bullshit that we get in it. We're all on the floor, it's right and wrong and everything else, and we just start just to be at peace and only the rest. But, you know, and you realize there is not heaven or hell, it's just being in this moment.
And the dialectic then tends to focus more on the play of the back and forth. I mean, in my experience, it was to heaven and hell go away in the shadow and the ego and so they'll go away, but the play of the back and forth, that becomes more interesting than the opposites, than focusing on the opposites.
Well,
and that's a release.
Holding that, but to be that thing the yin and the yang, you know, you're holding that energy,
okay.
you're bringing it within your own psyche to balance, and it's about balance.
Yeah, except I don't, for me, at least, I don't hold it. It holds me. It holds me. Let me see what I mean by that play. I wrote a book on play once, and I quoted this great philosopher in Germany, Hans-Georg Gadamer, in the book, and lo and behold, he was hired by Syracuse University and came as a visiting professor. And one day he said to me, I noticed I had this afternoon seminar on Thursday, so Aristotle, and then after the seminar was over, everybody goes home. He said, doesn't anybody drink beer in America? He said, at Heidelberg, we go after the seminar and have a beer. Can we talk more about Aristotle? Or whatever? And I said, well, I drink. And he said, oh, good. Could we? Yeah, sure. Well, meanwhile, the chair of the department told me he saw Professor Gadamer carrying a book. And the young professor, like, whoa, maybe I said something about my book. I quote him. So the first week goes by, and a couple of beers, and nothing. Second week, nothing. Third week, nothing. Fourth week, nothing. Fifth week, three beers. Like the three glasses of wine. And he says, oh, Mr. Miller, I read your book. And there was a long pause. And I'm really nervous. And he said, well, you almost got the point. So it's quiet, and then he saw him as crestfallen. So he wrote it. So he said, he said, it's not your fault. The problem is you speak English. he said, you know, in German, that, you know, we don't play a game. It's ein Spiel, Spiel. That it's the same word, the noun and the verb are the same. Or he said in French, jouer un jeu. Same word, same verb. He said in English, uniquely in the languages of the world, you have a double. The noun and the verb, you play games. And he said, so Americans think it's all fun and games. That's not what question. Remember, Gingrich, when he talks about the interplay of the dialectic, it's German. Right? You think of it in German. So I said, well, Professor Gunnar, could you sort of explain that? So he sort of went into the teacherly mode and he said, yes, do you ride a bicycle? Do you ride a bicycle? He said. I said, yes, I ride a bicycle. He said, you know that, the axle on the truck wheel? He said, you know those two nuts that hold the wheel on? He said, yes, sir. I know that. He said, well, you can't do this, but if you could tighten them all the way down, what would happen? I said, well, the wheel wouldn't turn. Then ride a bicycle. He said, exactly. You have to leave a little play in. He said, it has to do with space. He said, it's not. He said, most life isn't fun. And it's not games. But he said, even in the serious stuff and the tragic stuff and the nightmares of people from Iraq, you can find the spielraum, the playroom in it. In every marriage, there's got to be a little playroom. Every love affair, every friendship, every therapy. Little spiel, little play. That's what I think of poetry. Thanks very much.